Well, it's now a little after 2, and it looks like we have a quorum, so I will go ahead and call this meeting to order. We'll start with introductions. My name is Ryan Wilson with Wilson Architects, and I'm the current DEEB president.
Seth Pauling with AKS Engineering.
Andrew Gunther with PLS Engineering.
Les McDonald with Clark Regional Wastewater District.
Victoria Abram, Community Development and Building Safety.
Brent Davis, Community Development.
Maya Bunch, Community Development.
Michelle Finley, Community Development.
And Jamie Huslin, Jordan Ramis.
Diana Nutt, Development Engineering.
Dan Weisner, Osprey, or Songbird Homes.
Houston Aho, Aho Construction.
Naomi Paribanla, Development Engineering.
Justin Wood, Clark County Association of Realtors.
Is there anyone else online? I'm going to go really slow here to let Eric have a chance to sit down and introduce himself.
Eric Malimo, SGA Engineer.
Thank you. Just as a reminder, this DEEB meeting is being recorded and the audio will be posted on the DEEB's website. First order of business is to review and adopt the minutes from our June meeting. Has anybody had a chance to review those minutes?
I've reviewed and make a motion to approve.
Second.
Excellent. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Thank you very much. That passes. Next, review upcoming events. Victoria.
For the month of July, it's not on the agenda, but there will be a council meeting or 7:15 at 6 p.m. for the spring biannual code updates. And then for the county council work sessions, there will be one every Wednesday for July. So July 9th, 9 a.m. for the Pacific Corp presentation. Regarding the proposed transmission line and the fairgrounds master plan. On July 16th at 9 a.m. will be for the comp plan ADA transition plan. On Wednesday, July 23rd at 9 a.m. we'll have the code update 2026 environmental public health fees and the Vancouver Lake Management Plan. On July 30th at 9 a.m. we'll have the comprehensive plan update housing code and the annexation discussion with the City of Vancouver. For the Planning Commission work sessions, there will be a work session on Wednesday, July 10th, 5:30 p.m., and that will be regarding the Comp Plan Policy Housing Element Chapter 2 and the Transportation Element Chapter 5. There are no public hearings scheduled for July as of yesterday.
What day was the first one you mentioned on the biannual?
The biannual, 7:15.
7:15.
6 p.m.
6 p.m.
That work session on July 16th, it says ADA transition plan. Does anybody know, is that ADA as in American Disabilities Act ADA? What's the transition plan there? I guess what's being, does anybody know what they're discussing?
This is Naomi Paribanla. I have a very high level knowledge that it is coming from long range planning. Mike Salas, I believe, is taking the lead. He's with community planning. And it is related to disability and ramps.
Okay, thank you. With that, we will move on to member announcements. Are there any member announcements?
Yep. All right. Thank you so much. Nice chat. Bye.
I think so.
I would just like to give a moment to Maya Bunch to introduce herself as part of the member announcements.
Great.
Good afternoon, everybody here in person and online. My name is Maya Bunch. I am currently the interim community development director. I know we all said farewell to April 1st at the beginning of June. I'm going to be the interim director for the foreseeable future, but wearing the director hat full time. I think there was question about how deep action items were going to be addressed, you know, in the interim role, and our procedures will remain steady. We will address them full circle across the leadership board. And I look forward to working with all of you. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you for coming. I really appreciate it. Do you know how the new selection process is going? Is that something where they're hiring an outside firm or?
For this role?
Yeah.
For the director role? Currently, there's not an open recruitment. I'm in the role full time in the interim capacity, of course. So there will be a point whether it's either I'm appointed to it or not. Yes. Any other questions? I don't mean to cut off.
No, that's fine.
Okay, thank you.
Not really an announcement, but just kind of our work plan, kind of going over. We met a little while ago about the road mod committee, and we had some information that was presented. I feel like we still need to revisit that. That's been just an ongoing issue, and I think most of the engineers that have worked with the road mod committee have struggled with the process. So I'd like to come back and really make sure that we get a process that works, that's collaborative, that's productive, and, you know, kind of starts with, you know, problem solving and you know, starting at yes, trying to find a way to make things work and understand the process and have that communication back and forth. So I don't know if we can put that back on our agenda. There was a memo we got, but I don't know that it's, you know, that's been implemented yet and what the county's plan is for that committee.
Hey, Eric, this
thinking
is,
this is, go ahead.
Can I jump in? This is Jamie. I 1000% agree with you, Eric, on this, and I think it needs to be top priority right now. There's a lot of road modifications that traditionally would have, I think, gone through that are getting denials, and it's resulting in situations where the county is basically committing a taking at this point on some projects.
Are you guys foreseeing that as a like a workshop that we would have with the road mod committee, or
it'd be nice to have someone who is on the road mod or the entire committee come and explain the process, you know, how things are happening, and then maybe we can help them make it better. That's kind of why we're here. We're here to collaborate with them and to find processes where there's room for improvement. I think this is a really good example of something we could. It's low hanging fruit, so it's something that we could help with and hopefully improve the process.
I was able to speak with Naomi about, because I did have a note for a follow-up on this DEEB agenda for that. However, it's tentatively scheduled for a September follow-up at a DEEB meeting.
I think traditionally we take August off anyway, so that makes sense.
So that's a good transition. I was actually going to bring that up. I think that can be a discussion we maybe have outside of this current meeting, but was whether or not to have the August meeting or to skip it. So my hunches were leaning towards skipping August, but I didn't want to unilaterally say that. All right. Any other member announcements?
I guess one item we'd had someone reach out with questions on the when post-decision reviews are required and associated with final engineering submittals. I know we did see follow-up from Brent on that. And I guess I don't know if there's anything more that we have to take up and if it's if maybe Brent, you could elaborate on whether that's across the board when there's engineering revisions, because I know our concern was is that if often we have some modifications between the preliminary design and the final design, and you know, if post-decision review is required every single time, it adds a lot of process that's not really necessary. So
yeah, that's a good point. I mean, it's whether that has been how we've done it in the past, maybe that's another place that we could improve. There's times when it's appropriate. If there's a condition that needs to be changed, then usually a post-decision review needs to be done. If it's a change in concept, it still falls within the code. I don't know, it is extra process. And we're trying to figure out ways to make things more efficient. So maybe something we can add to an agenda to look at, you know, reforming that process as well.
I was just going to jump in and say that was whether or not, and I'm not sure that this is a member announcements item, and maybe it ought to be a future agenda item. I don't know. Is that something, what do you think, Brent?
Yeah, I think that's something that Naomi and I would collaborate on, because I can say the specific issue that has come up recently is stemming from a revision to the stormwater design that is question of whether it rises to the level of a significant change as specified in the stormwater manual, which actually does say that significant changes to the stormwater design do require a post-decision review. And as Eric indicated, for at least from the land use side of things, what we generally try to look at is the issue specified in a condition. And in particular, we're more sensitive in a type 3 hearings examiner decision. We have a little more flexibility with administrative decisions to interpret conditions. But we have seen a few cases where even though staff agreed a post decision wasn't warranted, the examiner unfortunately established conditions that required it in certain cases. So I'm happy to work with Naomi and come back to you at a later date and talk about that specifically as it relates to engineering revisions.
Okay. Yeah, I think that would be good. At least maybe so that we could have a better understanding of what those triggers are. And okay. Any other member announcements before I close this item? Okay, let's move on to EV charging stations. This is, I guess I'm one of the co-presenters on this one. So I'll just start off by saying, yeah, this is sort of a follow-up to a discussion we had a couple of months ago that came from an RCW that, I don't know, at least I have gotten a lot of questions from clients about and how to interpret it and how to implement it and what's actually required. So I guess we're looking for an update from Michelle. So go ahead and take it away.
Hello. So I'm not sure what happened the last time. I got the memo just stating on you're asking about the employees, or are you talking about all EV charging stations in general?
I think it's specifically the item in the RCWs related to A, E, and M occupancies.
Okay.
Where it's, yeah, that the EV parking count is tied to staff parking spaces only.
Excuse me. Yes. So if you have less than 10 designated parking spots, which a lot of companies don't really designate employee parking spots, you don't designate it, then you follow down into exception 2. Which is you, and I should have brought more, or do you have a copy of it? Sorry.
No.
So exception 2 basically says that in these groups, A, E, and M, whichever one is greater, you have one for every 200 parking spots. So it's actually going to be from 10 to 200 because 1 to 10 is exempt. You don't need an EV parking spot for employee parking spots from 1 to 10. So from there on, 10 to 200 parking spots, you now comply with either 2.1 or 2.2. So basically, then you just go back down to your 10%.
Well, 2.1 says the provisions of this shall apply only to designated employee spaces.
Right. Right. So if you don't have them, then you'll go to 2.2, one of each 200 parking spots, because normally you'll have, let's say, like a Winco where you have 350 parking spots, but you don't really designate parking spots in there. It'll just be included with your parking spots.
But if you are designating employee spaces, you would only have to provide 10% based on the designated.
One for every two, up to 200, yes, and then 10%.
Are you looking at? Is that something we have in our packet?
Oh, no, sorry. This is the actual RCW. Oh, okay. It states one of each 200 parking spaces or fraction thereof shall be EV ready. One of each 200 parking spaces or fraction thereof shall be an EV charging station. So if you're not doing, if you're not designating a parking spot, parking spaces, then you just add it in your total parking.
Is there an interpretation where we could, you know, it's hard to designate employee parking. Just that. I mean, most people don't. I mean, you, I guess you could just say, hey, these are going to be employees.
So, yeah, I think that's the point. If you're not actually designating, then you would do the one for 200. If you are designating, then it's 10% of the employee spaces.
Okay.
And when I asked this, because we had a WABO last month when this was brought up, and I asked them that, and they're like, we don't care. We don't designate. We don't pay attention to the employee designation, or they don't monitor it. So when you guys asked this question too, it was like, okay, so this kind of, they just basically included in the total parking.
You mean
with the
1 to 200?
Yes.
Okay. So the default is kind of the 1 to 200.
Well, 10 to 200.
What's that?
10 to 200, because the first two up. So number one says less than 10 doesn't require designated parking spot. So basically anything 10 to 200.
And then once you hit that, it's one per how many?
200.
Okay. Oh, no, oh, no. How many EV-ready stalls do you have?
Oh, then you go to the 10%.
The table. Yeah. 10%.
Yeah.
Okay. 10%.
Yeah. And do you have the code?
I mean, I can look up the RCW.
Okay, yeah.
But what is the RCW?
Well, it's in... I'm going to have
it. Okay.
I know where to find it.
Okay. Section 429.
Yeah, that's in the IBC, Washington State Building Code.
Okay. I can just snap a picture of it and then move on if anyone else needs it.
So I guess the key is whether or not you're specifically designating them. And then
anybody else want this?
But I don't think land use, you guys won't specifically ask for designated, and I don't know how many.
Yeah, they're not required. Yeah, it's just if you did, like a common one would be, because E is one of them, and E is like a high school, and high schools frequently have a employee parking lot and then a student parking lot. So that would be an example of where you'd have something that was specifically designated as staff parking. And I suppose you could, I mean, Winco could put some signage that said staff parking only.
Yeah, I remember when I used to work in the mall back in high school, they had a line back where employees, that's where everyone had to
park. Right.
So I don't know if they do that anymore, but.
Right. So then it would just be 10% of those if you have, if they were designated.
Mm-hmm. So alongside of that, it mentions that the number of spaces required for each occupancy, it is that specific to the required parking or provided number of stalls?
It would be, well, I'd have to have it in front of me, but I'm pretty sure it's provided. But we would look at, I don't really go through and count them when they're there. So whatever you guys put on there, I do 10% of that. So I guess provided. But I can double check in on that one as well. says required for each occupancy. Right under here. It says, so whatever is required for each occupancy.
All right. Does anybody else have any other questions for Michelle? All right. Thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
Done.
All right. Next is the compact lots memo. Brent.
Okay, hopefully this will be quick. I just put together a brief memo regarding staff's interpretation of the language in the compact lots code that triggers the narrow lot standards. There has been a lot of question and confusion about this, but essentially the way that we're interpreting the reference to the narrow lot standards is that it specifically applies to the development standards in section C of the narrow lot standards. And so the applicability provisions technically do not apply on top of the compact lot code. So that essentially means that as written, any lot and compact lot development is subject to the narrow lot standards, regardless of the number of lots less than 40 feet wide or lots that are greater than 40 feet wide. They still technically are subject, if they're in a compact lot development, still subject to the narrow lot standards. So in looking at that, I just went through and some of the specific standards that are there to sort of outline how they apply to compact lots. The first one is the requirement for a site plan. Regardless of how we interpret the reference, that would still apply because the site plan standards in the narrow lots are specifically referenced as the site plan requirement for compact lots. Probably the biggest impact is the guest parking requirement. I just pointing out that because of Senate Bill 5184, sometime within the next 18 months, the county is required to revise our parking requirements and guest parking will go away. We've already had confirmation that we will no longer be able to require guest parking for residential uses. Under that statute. So in the interim, we're stuck with it for now, but eventually in the foreseeable future, the guest parking impact will be going away. The next one is the street tree requirement of one per lot. So I guess in looking at it with lots that are wider than 40 feet, I think at least for public rights of way, the 30-foot minimum street tree spacing still applies. So this requirement from the narrow lot standards really would impact you more for larger lots if you're doing a private road within your compact lot development that's not subject to the street tree requirements. And then the next one is a solid waste collection. Under narrow lots, you do have to potentially provide a common area for solid waste collection, but only if it's infeasible to do it on a lot-by-lot basis, which I think is generally pretty rare. But that is one requirement. A few other things. Under the narrow lots, your site distance triangles for corner lots. And if you are providing off-street guest parking, those can be excluded from your density calculations under the narrow lot standards. So that's maybe a small benefit of being subject to those standards. showing driveway locations on your site plan. The narrow lot standards say you have to only have to do that for corner lots if as long as you are providing a detached sidewalk with ADA compliant for your street frontages. Now, again, that's going to be potentially become an issue if you're doing private roads where you're not required to do a detached sidewalk. There may be some cross sections for certain public street classifications that might fall into. But it's just showing your driveway locations on your site plan, which I suppose could pose a problem down the road for potential post decision review if you need to make a change when you get to final on those. Beyond that, the remaining narrow lot standards are optional as far as my reading of them was. So that's where we're at. I know that this was a question that was brought up at the last deed meeting to look at, and I just thought I'd go ahead and go over that with you. One thing I have been thinking about, because I don't think it was really fully thought out or conceived that we would be seeing narrow lot or compact lot developments with lots that are actually wider than 40 feet. But certainly in the R110 and R120 districts, that's probably going to be the case most of the time, or at least a fair amount of the time. And, you know, one thing that I would definitely be willing to look at is clarifying the reference to the narrow lot standards and potentially adding, specific language that states that those standards apply to lots that are 40 feet or less in the compact lot development. So then the only difference would really be that in compact lots, any narrow lot would be subject to those standards, whereas for standard development, you have to have 25% or more of your lots as narrow lots to trigger those requirements.
Yeah, just from being on the different committees and going through the HOSAP and the old narrow lot standards, I agree with pretty much everything you're saying on here. And one's really, and I don't think we anticipated this. I think this is kind of a narrow gap where you'd assume that if you're doing compact lots, then they're going to be narrower than 40 feet. But even in the compact lot standards, what it says basically is that, you know, they also apply if applicable. Now, it triggers it. You have to look at the compact lot standards, but the compact lot standards within those have certain criteria based on the size of the lot. So if you're doing compact lots, if you're following the compact lot standards and you have some lots that are compact and some that aren't, the parking in particular is very specific, where basically it says that you need one guest parking space for every lot under 40 feet. So it is true that if you're doing the way the code's written right now, that if you're doing a compact lot, you also have to look at the narrow lot standards. But the narrow lot standards also have applicability criteria within them. So I agree with the site plan. I agree with the waste collection, because as a whole, the development's functioning like narrow lots. But in the narrow lots, if you have, half the lots that are under 40 and half that are over, you have to provide guest parking for the ones under 40, not for the ones over 40. They should be treated the same because they have the same criteria as a compact lot development or a narrow lot. I'm sorry, I'm interchanging them because it's easy to do. But the narrow lot standards have applicability for the parking.
So the way we are interpreting the reference in the compact lot standards, the reference to the narrow lot standards, are the interpretation that we have made is that the applicability criteria in the narrow lot standards do not apply to compact lots, because the reference refers to the standards of the narrow lot standards section, which is section C of those standards. And that's where the problem is.
So why? I mean, what I see, this is one of those examples where we're putting semantics over intent. Well, and when you look at intent should control. When you're looking at things, you look at like the condition, and then you look at the finding, and then you look at the intent. the semantics are, okay, you have a choice which way to go. Why not look at the intent and what was applied? Because why would we require extra parking stalls for something here if it's over 40 feet and they're not compact lots or narrow lots?
I'm not arguing with the, you know, the logic of what you're saying. I'm just talking about how the code is written. And if you take the interpretation that we apply the reference based, you know, towards the entire narrow lot section, there's no point in even having the reference there because it would apply anyway if the narrow lot standards are triggered. So, and that's why I'm suggesting that a code amendment to clarify that those standards should only apply to lots that are 40 feet or less is something that I would definitely support, because I agree with you. It doesn't make sense to apply those standards. But that's the way it was written in the process of coming up with this interpretation. I communicated with community planning, and this is where we landed.
Okay. So if you're looking at what the code says, it says that if you're doing a, let me make sure I get my terms right. If you're doing a compact lot development, you're also subject to the standards of the narrow lot standards. So you put a new code section, now you have to apply. Then you apply the narrow lot standards. The narrow lot standards say that if you have a lot under 40 feet, then you have to have a guest parking. You're following them if you do that.
But the way it's structured in the narrow lot code, the standards of the narrow lot code are in section C. The 40 foot trigger for narrow lots is in section B. And that is the applicability section of the narrow lot code. The standards are found in C, and that's where we've gotten stuck.
Well, that was just an oversight. I mean, I agree with the doing a code section to clarify it, but I think in the interim, it should be a memo saying this was the intent and we're going to follow this until the code gets changed, because it really could go either way. I see what you're saying, but it doesn't make it. It doesn't follow logic. And why are we not following logic when we should be following logic and we should be following the intent? We're just going with semantics because someone made a typo. If someone makes a typo and they say something wrong, are we just going to, you know, put in a cub instead of a curb because someone put the wrong letter in there? We should follow the intent. And I believe that you guys have the ability to make a decision as a responsible official to say, our intent was this. We're going to apply those standards to the, you know, lots under 40 feet. And then it doesn't even matter anyway, because it's going to be, you know, changed in 18 months and we're not going to have those standards. But this is just kind of an example of, I think, how we could maybe do things a little bit better to handle these interpretations, so we're not just going with semantics over logic.
I think that's a broader discussion, but the direction I've been given is that regardless of intent or perceived intent or agreed intent, the code says what it says, and that's what was adopted by council. And if we need to correct it, then we need to go through the process to correct it. But I think in this case, you know, I certainly am willing to explore with Maya a management interpretation that we would only apply those standards to 40 lots, 40 feet or less. It wouldn't necessarily be changing our interpretation of how it applies, but just to clarify that the intent was that it would still only apply to the lots 40 feet or less, regardless of the number of them in the compact lot.
So can we make, I'll make an motion that we recommend to staff that they apply it based on the intent, not kind of the core language or the, you know, misinterpreted language that wasn't clear in the code, because I think we're pretty clear that if you have under 40, you shouldn't require an extra parking stall and it goes away. So I guess that would be the motion is to, in the interim, before the code can be changed, that staff basically apply what the intent was with the 40 feet.
Okay, we have a motion.
Yeah, I'd second that motion.
Okay, we have a motion and a second. Once again, the motion is to recommend to staff to apply the intent of the narrow lot standards, but they should only apply to 40-foot wide narrow lots in a compact lot subdivision.
Yeah, and to clarify the rest of Brent's memo, those are more of project-specific things. It's not the narrow lot standards specifically exclude parking stalls for lots over 40 feet. So it's really just the parking.
Right.
Everything else that Brent said on here, totally agree with. And you're looking at it holistically, and it makes sense. And the intent was to have a site plan. It was to look at the planning like garbage things when you have smaller lots. So if you have any of them that are smaller, you should meet those other things because it makes sense and it follows the intent. The parking's really the only outlier. And that was clearly the intent was, you know, the 40 feet. And it's really irrelevant in 18 months anyway. But in that interim, that's what we'd recommend.
And on that point, it does specifically state that it's one guest parking for every three narrow lots. So
and it specifies 40.
Yeah. Okay. Sorry.
The challenge is technically we don't have a definition in the code of narrow lots. The standard is in the applicability language of the narrow lot standards. If we had a definition in 40.100.070 for a narrow lot that said lots less than 40 feet wide, then this would not be an issue.
The narrow lots are defined as under 40 feet wide in the applicability of the narrow lot standards. We find that here.
Well, I think that was your point. It was like that's the only place it's defined, right? Is in the applicability.
Correct.
Yeah.
So yeah, narrow lots here. This section applies to newly platted residential land divisions having lots less than 40 feet wide as measured. So that's considered a narrow lot.
If I may, I guess the question I have is whether or not, Brent, you feel that you have the authority to do an interpretation as is being suggested within the framework of the code and what you have for authority in your position or the department has. Is that something you can even do?
Yes, that's within Maya's authority.
Okay.
To interpret the code, particularly where the plain language is not clear, which I think we agree is not the case here. So it just comes down to a question of whether the interpretation that's being asked for is something we believe we can defend.
Okay, great. We've had a motion and a second, so I will take the vote. All in favor of the motion?
Aye.
Aye.
Anyone opposed? All right, it passes. Can I just ask one? It has nothing to do with that discussion, but the 18 months, is that when the parking standards, that's the kind of the broader parking or residential stuff, the 5184.
Yeah, so 5184 gives local governments 18 months from, I believe it was July 27th.
Yeah.
To adopt compliance standards. I'm not sure what our process is going to be. I personally believe we have enough complexity in our parking standards that it's probably going to be beyond a biannual code amendment. But that decision is still being reviewed.
Okay. Yeah, that was what I was going to ask is if you had even a guess, and I don't mean to put you on the spot
there's about 14 places in Title 40 at least that provide various parking standards. And I think even beyond that, the bigger complexity is that particularly for site plan review, we have triggers based on increased parking requirements, and those triggers may be rendered moot if we don't figure out another way to address those.
Okay. I don't know about anybody else, but I've actually had clients ask about that when I think that the county is going to adjust their parking standards based on SB 2184. So it'll probably be a while. All right. Thank you. All right. That concludes our regular agenda. So I will now move on to public comment. Is there anybody who has any public comment?
Yeah, I've got one, especially since Brett brought up the discussion around this compact lot and the narrow lot crossover. I'm bumping my head up against a couple of little interpretations within the code modification. I was wondering if anybody else had anything that they've been bumping their heads against to see if there's other clarification that we need to get in front of the Clark County. I wrote a memo and sent it to Brent so he could review it. I don't think we need to bring it up here, but just overall in general, is there some other things that we should be compiling and bringing forward to this committee? I hear none.
Was there a specific section that you were referring to there, or?
Yeah, I've got, well, I mean, I could discuss it. I mean, it comes down to, there's a couple different things. One of them is like the density transfer code section 40-220-010-4 is only applicable to single family detached, even though we're allowed townhouses in all those zones now. So you can't do any density transfer. There's no benefit of doing density transfer if you're trying to put for townhouses. And the reason I bring this up is because you guys all know that I've done a lot of townhouses. I'm very comfortable with them. And then, you know, just there's some math stuff. If you look at doing townhouses in the R110 zone, you're to be at max density, you would only have a utilization rate of 71%. And there's been times where I've gotten up right around 80, and I've actually gone even farther than that when I've had some stuff that we're at no road development, just a little tiny infill lot. So that could certainly be an issue. In R120 zone, max density will limit townhouses to 48% utilization. So if the goal is to create as much density as possible within the county, we are going to struggle if we use these codes. So, and then the footnote one of table 40-220-010-2, if you read it restrictively, which staff is, you know, is, I believe that they're mandated by state law to be able to do that. It says that it can be argued that each lot has to meet the minimum lot size. So if you have to meet the minimum lot size, there's no benefit of doing a PUD within the new code and trying to put on there the middle house, the missing middle housing, which is duplex, triplex, quadplexes, or townhouses or cottages. So that was just some examples that I found as I poured through the code and tried to lay out a development in about 8 different ways to try and meet density there's a whole bunch of issues that are going on with it. So anybody else that has bumped into some stuff? Doesn't sound like anybody else has. I just figuring after a year of using the new code, we've probably seen enough of these different projects. And I know that when the consultants usually bump into problems, you know, time is money, and we just proceed forward with the way that we can get it to go through. So.
Yeah, we knew when we wrote that code as part of the HOSAP that there was going to be some things that needed to be tweaked because, you know, we hadn't run through a stress test yet. And when you run it through, you start noticing these things. And what you do have to go back on is the intent of what we were doing. And that's kind of what I wanted to kind of say earlier, because, you know, the intent was pretty clear. The language was not clear. And we do the best we can. And I was on that committee. I'm partially to blame for that poor language because I didn't catch it.
I was on it too.
Yeah, but I know what the intent was. And I think what it is, you know, when we look at it, we can go back to the committee. We could ask them what the intent was, you know, what did we try to do? And we could fix it and we can come up with the best interpretation. And we're going to have to fix it. We're going to have to tweak it because you're not going to catch everything the first time. I kind of have an ongoing list, too, of just some little things. There's like a typo or something about some references the FR40 code. Narrow lot code references 40.260. There's some weird reference in there. There was a typo. Just an interesting thing. We already came up with the driveways, like shared driveways, if you put a duplex or a triplex on it, how you measure those. And I think we came up with a interpretation that was very reasonable from staff that, okay, it applies to the number of lots, not the number of units on that lot. Otherwise, the driveway standards get all goofed up. And the intent was that you treat that lot, you treat a duplex, triplex the same as you would a single family home. So yeah, even though you might have more than four units off of a private driveway, then it should be interpreted for four lots, four structures. Highway 99 standards, that is something that we still need to revisit because the Highway 99 standards conflict directly with the housing options study and some of the interpretations on there, especially for attached. They have all these restrictive standards that make, you know, any kind of attached very difficult to do in Highway 99. And we got rid of, in another code process, we got rid of all the residential stuff in the Highway 99 because really it was more for, you know, commercial. But for some reason, we left something in there that said detached single family instead of any single family. And now that we can allow duplex triplexes, just like Dan mentioned on the density transfer, we need to catch those other references, other places in the code, because the intent of the state rule is that you have to allow them on any lot. So if we have other restrictions on them, we're basically not allowing them where we should be allowing them. And again, that wasn't the intent. So I think this is where staff and management has that opportunity to kind of look at that intent and to use some common sense and to go, okay, this is what we should be doing. We will fix the code with updates as we see it, and we keep an ongoing list, and that's what biannuals are for. So more of a policy thing, there is a 10-foot perimeter setback for compact lots, but there's not a 10-foot perimeter setback for townhomes, which are arguably more intense on the neighbors than the compact lots. So should that be there? Just that's more of a question. That isn't clear that the intent wasn't to have the 10 feet in there. So I'm not going to argue that it was. That's something that a policy thing that maybe it doesn't need to be there if we're really trying to encourage those housing types. I don't know. I've got an ongoing list that I've just been kind of like jotting down, but it's probably a little bit more than this. Maybe once we kind of revisit that, we can have a meeting with the housing options group and we can kind of bring all the stuff we found and we could, you know, tweak it to make sure it works after we've stress tested it for a year or so. So. And we figure out what the issues are.
Yeah, that wouldn't be a bad idea to kind of just build that into the HOSAP. And maybe we can even bring that in up with the multifamily, is that you do a 1-year anniversary debrief or something.
That's why I was bringing it up. You know, kind of how do we want to help staff to clarify some of these codes that we're catching these constrictions, you know, do we just compile a list and hand it over? It sounds like, you know, Eric's got some list and Ryan, you had some. I've got, you know, that one. I've got, you know, another one that was, I looked at like the Mill Creek overlay says that minimum, if you do a density transfer, a PUD, it's got to be a 9,000 square foot lot in an R110 zone. Well, you know, code now allows you to do 8,500 square foot. So you basically, it disincentivizes doing PUD and it, you know, try and get any more densification. So how can we help staff?
I'd be happy to take those and keep a running list because staff runs into some as well.
Okay, that'd be awesome. And then we
can feed it back through Deeb when you're ready to try to suggest taking it forward to the committee for review.
Okay. Awesome. Thank you, Brent.
Hello, I'm James Clark, Clark Land Design, and my project is the one that kind of brought this whole narrow lot standards forward. And I have the project has one standard size lot that's like 13,000, and then it's got three compact lots. They're going to be accessed by a joint driveway, so there's not even any private roads involved. And so a lot of this stuff just doesn't apply because none of the lots in this little infill are even close to 40 feet wide. So 55 foot wide typically on the compact lots. And so and then the large lot could be a fourplex, triplex, duplex. So anyway, I'm just here in the same boat with the stress testing of the new code, and I concur with everything that Eric said. One thing though that I would ask a question on, with the additional site plan required typically for narrow lots and compact lots, does the county charge an additional fee similar to the short plat fee, or is there a reduced fee? Because there's, when you do a short plat or a subdivision, you have to do a site plan anyway. You've got all the, lay out all the roads and utilities and all of that stuff, and so you're really only adding, you know, trash pickup areas to that site plan. And so I don't know what the additional fees are for the site plan, but if you've got like an extra $6,000 to $10,000, you know, added to the project on one of these infills. I know the goal that the state had for the House bill was to drive density into these underdeveloped parcels. And with these underdeveloped parcels, any additional costs like that can kill the project. And so because they've already been passed over by previous development, and now you're relying on this additional density to make it feasible. And so we need to be careful adding additional fees to those processes. And so I would just say that with us, if we're going to require an additional site plan, that we maybe look at concurrent fees, you know, on those. And the other thing that was confusing about me for me was looking at the, you know, not having any narrow lots and then having to go to the narrow lot standards. And I think that it may be better to revise the compact lot code such that, you know, if you had a flow chart, do you have narrow lots? Yes, go to the narrow lot standards. Do you not have any narrow lots? No, go to this section of the compact lot code. And if there are things in the narrow lot code that you want to carry into the compact lot code, then you bring those into that section and somebody can just basically go, okay, I don't have any narrow lots. I just provide trash pickup locations or whatever. You know, and if you want to do street trees or something like that, those would just go into that area. Currently, under the section C, it does say that guest parking is required for narrow lots, like Seth was saying. And the same thing goes for the street trees as well. And the only definition we have for narrow lots is, of course, in the narrow lot standard, like Eric was saying, but I think, what are you saying about the intent? I think you can look at that section C and still make a case for whether some of these things are applicable or not to these compact lots. So anyway, any questions?
I can respond to the fee question. So the site plan requirement for for narrow lots or compact lots is a submittal requirement. There's no actual additional review fee associated with that. It's just part of the land. It's just built into the land division fee, whether it's a short plat or subdivision.
That's good to know. Thanks.
Is there any other public comment? All right, very good. We are dismissed.